As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine and I'm now joined by Seb Stafford-Blore.
Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Seb. And of course, also joined by the one, the only, JJ Bull, the Bulldog, the Bullman, the Big Bull, the Jade Bull, the Bullover Watch.
Hello, Joe. Hi.
How's it going?
Really good. I'm very excited to be here. I really hope I don't let anyone down. Here we go.
Just leaving a bit of a space there, just to really let that message settle into you, JJ. It's very important that you don't let anybody down, because, of course, this is an important job. And speaking of jobs, JJ has left a national newspaper to work for a YouTube channel. JJ, just talk us through your thinking there, because it seems insane to me.
Well, I've done it now, so it doesn't really matter what the...
The details aren't important, are they?
I have watched TIFO and listened to the podcast for quite a while, so it's pretty cool. As I'm sure anyone who has also listened to it, I think it would be really cool to work for it. Also, it's just a really good thing to come and do, something different. I got into Telegraph originally by doing YouTube in the first place with a bunch of videos that were quite silly. So, yeah, I think it's a good fit.
It is extremely cool. I'm very happy that you're here.
And
for listeners, JJ will be appearing on the podcast regularly. He's going to start writing scripts of some of our videos for a new concept that we're working on. We'll be launching over the Euros too. JJ will be a central part. It's all very exciting for us to have him here. And I'm going to rag him up all episode. So that's going to be exciting to listen to as well. Okay, what did we talk about today? We talked about Manchester United and Liverpool's postponed game. We did a big bit on Newcastle, a big bit on Arsenal. We talked for a little bit less time about Chelsea and Everton and Tottenham. A little bit on the continent with Seb Stafford-Blore. And of course, also, we rounded things off in a Joe's Player Quotes and Facts database. It was a real fun episode, wasn't it, Seb?
Sure was, Joe. I had a really nice time.
It's been a long time since we, here's the secret of the trade. We record the intro at the end after we've already done the episode. And it's been a long time since we spoke about the protest bit. I'm now worried we said something awful.
Well, you did a couple of times. We've agreed to edit a few of those bits out. So I think you're okay.
Fine.
Yeah, be fine.
Good to know.
You've encouraged some fairly poor behaviour amongst society. So, but it's okay. Okay. The edit will save you, as always. It's okay.
Okay, well, before we get started, quick fire questions round for JJ so the audience can get to know him. Of course, he's been on the show before, but never as a member of the team. So a few questions quickly, JJ, if you don't mind. Quick fire. Yes. First one is VAR, yes or no?
It should be better than it is, but I think it's to do with a lot of the rules.
No,
follow instruction. Interesting, Joe.
Yes
interesting.
Or no? Yes or no?
Yes.
Wow. Goodness me, we should ask that in the interview. How about crowd sound? Yes or no?
Was no, now yes.
Oh, you're a yes man now. That's interesting.
Yeah. Okay. But I was really excited for it originally. I know this is not quickfire now, but I was really excited for to have no sounds. You could hear what the coaches and stuff were shouting. But now I like the sound because it makes it sound a bit more real. I don't know why.
Sure. Okay. Who do you support?
Aberdeen.
Yeah, okay, fine. That's a reasonable answer, isn't it? What would be your worst way to die?
Oh, I think drowning would be worst. Yeah.
Yeah.
That'd be a bad way to die.
Quite dark. Ever since I've watched Casino Royale, you know, I think it's fine to do spoilers now, isn't it? 15 years later when she breathes in all the water in the lift and, oh, God.
No, that's not good.
That's horrible. No. Not good at all. Have you got any quick fire questions for JJ, Seb?
Who did you hate most at the Telegraph?
That's the question for after the podcast.
That was my best spontaneous thinking. I'm sorry, I don't know what happened there.
Anyway, from that to this, that's everything I've got to say. Oh, also, I should say, hey, by the way, if you like it when people answer questions in an interesting way, you should visit theathletic.com/TIFO, where sometimes that happens. And often, if that does happen, those questions are the right questions, and the answers are interesting. And also, lots of stuff doesn't involve questions and answers as well. It's just, you know, one of the things that can happen there. Yeah. Also, there's a 30-day free trial. So if my description of this isn't very descriptive or to your tastes, you can just go and look at what it is for free, and by signing up with a 30-day trial, theathletic.com/TIFO, and then send me an email with what you think it is so I can better say it on the next episode of the TIFO Football Podcast. That's theathletic.com/TIFO. Now, there you go. Thanks to everyone involved in today's episode. One other thing to mention before we get started. There's no producer Adonis today. No, there's not. No producer Adonis. Why is that? Because he's gone done, had a baby. He made a new human and he's gone off to raise it. I think that's what they do. Yeah. At the beginning, they do a bit of raising because unlike other animals, human babies can't fend for themselves, can they? They don't come out already to spear a boar to death or anything. Actually, they can't do anything on their own for a really long time. So much so that it's caused some, you know, evolutionary biologists to wonder about this, you know, the origin of humans, because we're unlike many other animals in that sense. Yeah, not like the donkey that gets popped out and then it's stood up within a day and it's grazing, no big deal. Yeah. Years we're talking about, years. Adonis will be back before years, of course, but the most important thing now for him is to raise his small human, and we wish him all the best in doing that to producer Adonis and the newest little Tipo. There we go. Anyway, for now, we've got producer Ollie. Many thanks to you, producer Ollie. And maybe one of these future episodes, we'll chat to producer Ollie and we'll find some fun in that. I'm sure we will. But for now, I will leave you in the warm hands and the cool embrace of JJ Bull the Bullman. Let's begin now with Manchester United P Liverpool. And of course I say the letter P because the game was postponed due to safety concerns after a protest outside and inside the ground. Sounds like there were lots of COVID breaches. I don't know. But the game was postponed anyway. Police were involved in that decision too. Various reports of criminal damage. Adam Crafton did a good tweet though, Seb, where he said, to those patronising MUFC fans saying, this isn't the way, what would you like them to do? Failed by government when Glazers came in. They tried every form of polite protest. They set up a Phoenix Club. The owners did not engage. What else is left but non-violent direct action? Emphasis on the non-violent there.
Yeah, it's interesting because we've seen, not just with Manchester United, but we've seen protests before being kind of patted on the head, Joe. It's like, if you think of the many, many demonstrations that have been held around St. James's Park against Mike Ashley, for instance. It's interesting that, firstly, they seem to get dismissed very, very quickly. And secondly, they tend to receive nothing like the television coverage or the mainstream coverage that what happened yesterday did or what happened on Sunday did.
Yeah.
And you can't really have it both ways because it's sort of, and let me just profess this by saying that I'm not advocating direct action against football clubs or, you know, violence or whatever, but there's a point here in that you can't expect fans just to sit quietly in the corner while something they care about is taken away from them. And in this, you know, in this particular instance, it's been particularly egregious. So yeah, no, I agree with Adam's point. It's difficult because you're seemingly advocating for supporters to protest in a way which is easy to ignore, which kind of defeats the object of the protest.
Well, also, like, protesting sort of within, and there'll be many different takes on this, but protesting sort of within the current system and following all the rules, it's sort of not really protesting, is it? It's kind of like, you know, go on a march, obviously, and to many thousands of people who do that, some on a regular basis. It can make a difference, and in some cases it does make a difference. But you're absolutely right. There are plenty of football fans at different clubs with different issues that stand peacefully outside their grounds and, you know, they don't do any direct action at anything, at any buildings, for example, and everyone just ignores them. No one does anything. And then as soon as a big group of people step outside the sort of bounds of what is considered to be, acting polite in polite society, it's suddenly a problem. Now, of course, where violence is concerned, that's not cool. And it sounds like from the reports of yesterday that there was actually, in a couple of individual incidences, there was fairly extreme violence. And that sucks because not only does it suck for the victims involved, but it also ruins it for everybody else. Because if this big group of people had just broken into the stadium and the criminal issues in this case were purely, you know, a little bit of criminal damage to Manchester United's property, essentially a peaceful protest, then I think we'd be having a slightly different conversation.
The criminal damage aspect, I haven't seen a kind of full accounting of what happened there, so probably best not to comment. But what I'll say is that football's tendency and the football community's tendency when these kind of things happen, so think of the Bury situation. What you tend to get there, where ownership has done something unforgivable or where fans are being disenfranchised by the actions of ownership, is for a couple of days, everyone sits around, wrings their hands and says, oh, isn't this just terrible? Isn't this just awful? Isn't this the worst thing that happens? And then on like day four, everyone just forgets about it and moves on.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, that's not really recourse as a supporter, is it? So no. It's really difficult.
You got to throw yourself in front of the horse, JJ. Is that the right thing to say?
I don't know. Horses have had it hard in these protests too.
Yeah, they did. Exactly. That's true. Good point, JJ.
Some of them aren't ready to battle, you know? They weren't asked to do that. They're just nice horses. And here they are. Yeah. The weird thing about it is that also, like, it's not that I don't admire protesters, what I'm trying to say is, but I wonder how much effect it really has on the people they're trying to hurt. Like the Glazers, are they sitting there in their very wealthy room, if you have a wealthy room, watching this on TV going, oh no. Or is it, I mean, what eventually builds, is it that the protests then make you get loads of media coverage so that in turn makes them feel to the point they have to get out or something? I wonder what it does to those people.
I'm not sure.
Better to do something than nothing, for a certain, but yeah.
I guess maybe like the protest against the Super League would have hurt the owners last week versus this one. But then again, I suppose it's still it's a sort of very strange modern phenomena, isn't it? And we think about this in the context of football being that broadcasting income is a significantly greater source of income now than match day was, which is something that's happened in relatively recent footballing history. And it's an odd thing, isn't it? Because you sort of think, well, if you're protesting against the stock market, for example, you'd march on Wall Street. And you might be able to sort of stop some people going in and leaving their jobs, or you could have some kind of impact there. Or if you're protesting against a supermarket, you can stand outside and tell everyone not to go in. That would make a difference, I suppose. But with football, unless you get it taken off the telly, which in a way, I guess they did, it's difficult to actually find a way to do anything that would impact the owners, isn't it? Because there's no one was going to the stadium anyway.
You know what's really rubbish about this is that you're right. Like in this instance, actually, it's a success because they have inconvenienced big football, in inverted commas. At the same time, though, and this is typical of everything to do with modern football, it's something that has to also inconvenience the supporters themselves. So their victory is to deny themselves the ability to watch the biggest game of their season. I know it's a small thing and it's not really relevant, but it's kind of indicative of, well, the only way you can have an impact as a fan is by making some kind of compromise, you know, make some kind of concession from your own life. And that's that. You wake up on a Sunday morning, Man United, Liverpool, who isn't looking forward to that or dreading it if you're invested in one of the two sides. And so the cost is really paid by the fan themselves. I mean, I don't know, like, do the Glazer family sit around in their wealthy room and, you know, pull the legs off spiders? And
what does one have in a wealthy room, JJ?
Just a lot of gold, I reckon. Just a lot.
Those chairs that no one would sit on, but you might lie down on. You know, the sort of long...
Oh, a chaise lounge.
Yeah, one of those. Yeah. I think that... And like the TV might be hidden in a wall and come out when you want it to.
Yeah, a lot of stuff like tables can just come out of the floor. Just, you know, and sort of... It's more... It's not a wealthy room. It's more of a layer.
You've really got a great imagination there, Seth. In the richest room you can imagine, a table comes out of the floor. Well done. As if they need to... space save in the wealthy room. Listen, no, it was a bad day for
it's not space saving. It's just it's a kind of a superficial little detail so that, you know, when one of their inevitably vapid friends comes around, be like, oh, look at my table, isn't this impressive? And the vapid friend says, oh yeah, that's really cool, I really like that, because that's what...
No,
I've just gone further into it than you were willing to.
But they also definitely have paintings on the wall with the eyes cut out so they can go around the side of the wall. Except here it'll be a picture of like Joel Glazer, and then Joel Glazer will go behind the wall so you can't tell it's not his eyes following you around the room.
Listen, JJ, as much as Seb's laughing, there's something... I knew this was going to happen, okay? There's something I have to say at this point. I'm the funny guy on this
oh, sorry.
Podcast, okay? Seb is the sort of, you know, unwitting idiot. Alex is just is a dry guy who occasionally gets a laugh because he's dry, and when he's extra dry, people go, "Oh, isn't he dry?" And everyone goes, "Ha ha ha ha!" But listen, you're being a bit too funny for my liking. So just reel it in a bit, okay? Focus on what you're here to do, which is to support my funniness, okay? Otherwise, we're gonna have issues.
Okay, Dad.
Now, speaking of funny, hey. Actually, this has been sent to me by producer Ollie, who kindly reminded me that the person who had the worst day yesterday was Jay Glazer, cast member of Fox NFL Sunday and Ballers on HBO. I don't know, two different shows, it sounds like. Jay Glazer, who said, "Just to be clear, for the thousandth time as I woke up to this stuff sent my way on social media, my family is from Brooklyn, not Tampa. We do not own Manchester United." There you go, Jay Glazer. I'm sure you can expect more of that. Now, I noticed nobody laughed at what I said. Is there a laugh there? Or?
I had a question. I had a question. Because this is quite common. For instance, every time that Andre Villas-Boas loses his job, somebody with the Twitter handle AVB gets a torrent of abuse. Now, if you're the kind of person that's doing that, are you not checking the handle first? Are you just typing in, oh, at AVB, that's probably it. So if I wanted to abuse Joe, would I just type in at Joe Devine and not check that actually...
I bet there is one out there. We could all do that. Is that okay? You're allowed to incite...
I think we should check the contracts probably before we do things.
Tell
like
me
that,
who but... it is. Who's Joe? Yeah, are we allowed to dox that person? Don't want to dox anyone, do we?
No.
But let's have a quick look though anyway.
But you see what I'm getting at? It's just this kind of this... it's such laziness. Oh yes, that's probably him. I can't actually be bothered to check it, but... Let's just send it anyway. Let's send it first and worry about the consequences later, or, you know, whether I'm right later.
This guy has a beard.
Okay, but focus.
Joe Devine 96. Does not look like you.
No. Anyway, never mind. Listen, these situations are complicated by violence. And what was most interesting to me yesterday, I suppose, was watching Sky, because... You know, the pundits clearly had one view of it based on the protests, and everything was interesting. And Gary Neville, as per usual, made some, you know, interesting points and did a good job of commentating on it. And then the violent stuff happened, and then they sort of have to, you know, pull back quite a lot. So just, you know, if you're at one of these protests in the future, don't do the violence and everything's better. That's the message from Tifa there. I hope that's a good message. I just said it off the top of my head. We will talk in a moment about Newcastle and Arsenal. We'll be back to do that.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Okay, Newcastle 0-2 Arsenal. Why are we starting with this game, you ask? Well, we were going to watch the United-Liverpool one, and we watched this one first. There are some others in the list, but anyway, here we go. Elneny's first ever Premier League goal. How exciting. And a lovely flying volley strike thing from Aubameyang sees Arsenal back into the top 10. So that's a good start. And Newcastle probably still safe from relegation, being as they are 9 points clear of Fulham in 18th. Now, JJ, Newcastle, you think, or you thought yesterday, tactically played right into Arsenal's hands in this one.
Yes, I do think that. So what we've seen with Arteta's team recently is if you press them or you push them high up the pitch, they don't cope with it very well, and they don't offer much up front. He's got this tactical setup at the moment. It's like a ring formation. I was talking this with Alex of Tifo on Twitter recently, and what they do is they put all their players. So if you're playing against a team like Fulham, is the first time I noticed it. Fulham will sit back in a block, and so all the space is going to be wide. So he puts all his players wide around them like a ring, with one player at the base of the midfield in front of the block, and it just means that they pass it around forever and don't go anywhere with it. So sit back, nothing happens. And then eventually frustrate them, hit them on the counter. That's how you do it. What Newcastle did was they sat in a 5-3-2, which naturally shows all the play wide. But also, because they defended so wide across the pitch, there were spaces between players which allowed them to play line-breaking passes. So the players, in midfield especially, were able to get the ball through to Martinelli, through to Odegaard, through to Willian. Elneny and Ceballos able to do what they wanted to do. And Aubameyang was up front, not as a false nine, which is very important, and was able to get on the ball. And that was what they did. And they sat back, they didn't push them high, and they had nothing about them, really. It was really, really, really poor from Newcastle, from a game you think they would have been more up for.
How often have you noticed this ineffective ring thing? Because, for example, would Steve Bruce have been able to spot that in recent games and maybe prepare for it instead of doing the opposite?
Well, I don't know if he would have looked at it and think that's what he'll do, so I'll hit with this. I think what he wanted to do would be to block space and hit on the counter, because the way they're going to score is by getting Saint-Maximin to do something mental by running really fast at someone, and then Wilson will turn up to finish it off. I think that'll be the play. And they have this, so I think it worked better when they played a 5-4-1, and the way they kind of defend is it's a 5, but it becomes a 4, and then the ball side wing back pushes up to take on the wide player normally. So then they have an overload defensively, which tends to have worked. But because they sat so deep and just weren't able to get up with the ball, they changed after about 15 minutes, I think, and tried to push Matt Ritchie and Murphy higher up the pitch so they could engage earlier. And that made a bit of a difference. And in the second half, they changed to more of a kind of 4-4-2, which, again, made a bit of a difference, but just not enough. They just weren't... I think Steve Bruce said after the game that he went into them at halftime, like he really gave them a good telling to. And I think the problem they have is that their players are not as good as Arsenal's. That is a big problem they had.
Right.
Yeah. It's a secret of football, Joe, I've learned over a while. Yeah.
That does make sense. Sometimes I forget about that. Hey, you mentioned Saint-Maximin there. Air quotes, Newcastle's best player, right?
Yeah, for sure. He's also, it's quite easy, like, common to say, it's a joy to watch, but he really is. He's really fun because he doesn't seem to belong amongst where everyone else is. Like, he's not been through the academy system, so he doesn't do what you're supposed to as a footballer. It's just a bit of a, you know that It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia episode with a wild card? He's basically that. You put him in and he will do things you don't expect.
Yeah, it's like he doesn't even listen to us, man, you know?
Yeah, exactly. But it's the thing, he'd be infuriating to play with at five-a-side, and I think Matt Ritchie especially seems to find him annoying to play with because he's always looking at him with his arms out, like, pass the ball, which he has started doing more of since he's come back from injury, I've noticed. I wrote a thing, and the last thing I wrote for print before I before I left there. His passes per 90 are slightly up. His touches are slightly up per 90 as well. But also he's making slightly fewer dribbles, slightly fewer crosses, slightly fewer shots. But his chance creation has gone up as a result. So he's doing more for the team rather than only just running and trying to get on a highlight reel. He's playing the pass, then making the run, and that's making him more useful.
Yeah, we were talking about this yesterday, and it struck me that there's a Rocket League analogy in here of a player who, and I'm sure players of the Rocket League will be very familiar with this sort of player. Not to say that Sir Maximin is a ball chaser. That's not what I'm saying. But what I am saying is sometimes you have a team where one player is you know, mechanically much better than the other players on their team, and they score all the goals and they do all the cool looking things and they get the most points by far on the team, but they don't actually help the team whilst doing that. They're just kind of solo on the team, and then the team loses anyway, and that person sort of looks at the other teammates as if to say, "Oh, pull your weight, look at how many points I've got, and it's not my fault we've lost this one." And I think, well, actually, mate, it is, because if you, you know, and then you want to explain it to your TV screen, and you want to shout into a pillow or something. Yeah, you know, again, not a ball chaser, but someone who is significantly, you know, mechanically talented above and beyond his teammates, but perhaps that doesn't, or, you know, scoring lots of goals doesn't always mean that's the best thing for the team, right?
Well, I think so. And how do I explain it? It's a lot of... to apply to like five-a-side, for example, you get a lot of players at five-a-side who will... they will always stand wide up front. So five, it's probably sevens is a better analogy here, actually. It's seven. So they're standing wide up top. So you always need your depth and your width is what you need. And if you're standing wide up top, it doesn't actually do anything, because if you get the ball wide, often it means someone has to be deeper in the centre to give you space out wide. Then they'll run into the corner. You just funnel them down the corridor. They stay in that corner, and then they have to go back, because you can't score from the corner at sevens. You have to pass it, but you're often not allowed in the box, so there's no point being there in the first place. So you go backwards. The other team has time to get back and defend, and it's all pointless. But the players who do that,
you might hold
on
to the ball in that time and look cool and be a good dribbler while you're doing it, but it doesn't really help anyone.
Exactly. You can do a good dribble, and they might get shot away, but often they just get tackled all the time, and then they moan. They're always moaning all the time about like you not giving the ball to them every single time. But actually, what's better for the team would be if they're just in the middle, not getting the ball, but stretching the defence. And St. Maximin, what I've seen is that he's definitely had some coaching at Newcastle, and he's making far more passes in a game, I think. So against Arsenal, for example, he made 24 passes, which is compared to like Matt Ritchie at 29, is quite a lot. There are games before, I don't have the numbers up in front of me, but in past games, he would have the fewest passes of like any Newcastle player on the pitch. But he'd also have about 29,000 dribbles. Which, if you're trying to get out of your defensive shape, either you can get him to do it and it looks cool, and he's running 80 yards and leaving like fire trails behind him. But you could also just hoof the ball and chase it up and win the second ball. Like, it's sort of the same thing.
I've got some sympathy for him, though, because if you ask someone like Sam Maximin to be a system player in a Steve Bruce system, it feels like that's a really, really good way of negating any positive effect he might have. Like, I speak with some as someone who doesn't have to suffer the frustration of him being on my team. I don't have to, you know, deal with the kind of the Matt Ritchie situation, for instance. But if you just wanted him to be, if you just wanted him to be someone that expressed himself in the right situations, or as a kind of an extension of Newcastle's build-up, that kind of just involves him standing by the halfway line with his arms crossed for like 90 minutes, because it's Newcastle aren't really built to do anything other than give him the ball and hope that a couple of times a game he scores.
Sure.
The best goal ever scored in the history of the sport.
That's probably why it's confusing, right? Because I reckon at times he's probably been asked by Steve Bruce or whoever to just do what you can, lad, with the ball.
It feels like that, doesn't it? I mean, and this is kind of more of a commentary on Steve Bruce's Newcastle than it is on Alan Sam Maximin, but it is as if someone has said, "I'll just have a go. I mean, what's the worst that can happen? We're still going to have nine players behind the ball." And then, you know, Callum Wilson, 40 yards in the distance. But it's difficult. It feels like that's a legitimate part of Newcastle's game plan, for better or worse, is right, just give Alan the ball and let's see what happens. Let's see if he does score that goal.
Speaking of Newcastle's game plan, speaking of Big Brucey, Dr. Bruce, Steve Bruce, you know, I mean, they're probably safe from relegation, right? But there will still be supporters looking for change in the summer. And under Ashley, we've seen lots of managers come and go, even if Steve Bruce did go in the summer, which I think is far from certain now that safety is almost guaranteed, not quite. What is the short-term route to being less fucked? I've written down here. I don't know who wants to answer that. It's a toss-up. Off you pop.
I'll have a go at that one. The secret, I think, is buying better players.
Ah.
Yes, I believe this is the solution. I am not a big fan of the 5-3-2. It is a 5-3-2, not a 3-5-2 that they play. I think they could do something different. I don't know if Steve Bruce is the man for that because his teams have tended to be very... what is the word? Not even pragmatic.
Conservative.
Stodgy.
Maybe that's a word. Yeah. Just like good enough to finish maybe 12th. That's what they're good at. And you might have a brighter, younger manager who comes in and they could take them up to... I mean, where's the glass ceiling now? It's something like 8th, isn't it? You just can't really get above that unless you are taken over by a small state.
Country.
So
sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think there are players they can find, but... I mean, the way you get them in is get a young future superstar coming through from another club like Ajax, something like that, and putting out of thin air. And, you know, you build around there. I mean, Joe Willock, they've got just now an Arsenal wonder kid. So you think that might be someone who can take them up a step. But are they good enough right now to be able to play that slightly more attacking game? Do they? It's really difficult to know what to do. It's going to be a bit like what Sean Dyche is doing with Burnley, I think, at the moment, where you just have the same group of players largely and you maybe get one addition a summer if you can get them in. But you're mostly just trying to fight fires the whole time and just stay alive. And eventually you might get some run of momentum and that'll take you up. It sounds quite dour for a Newcastle fan. You're not going to have an awful lot of fun with it, I think. Not even in the cups. You know, you get so far, but you've got to focus on not getting relegated. I don't know. I don't know how you get out to being less fucked, but it's going to be just having better humans on your team, I think.
Okay. Well, let's talk about Arsenal, speaking of getting less effed. Hey, Arsenal were two goals down against Villarreal inside 30 minutes last Thursday. A second-half Pepe penalty provides some hope for the second leg, but it's not a position that Arsenal would have wanted to be going into in the second leg. Over at The Athletic, Amy Lawrence was asked if Unai Emery outthought Mikel Arteta. Her response, it felt more like Arteta outthought Arteta. She was, of course, in part referring to Arsenal not fielding a striker for the game. JJ, explain that, because I watched that in a pub and I was confused.
I agree with this idea that Arteta's outthinking himself.
I mean, he did learn from the best in Pep Guardiola, didn't he?
Well, yeah, exactly. But then that doesn't necessarily translate as him being immediately able to do it himself. It seems a bit to me.
No, I just mean overthinking the big game. That the old cliche.
Oh, Pep, I understand. You know,
Sorry.
But Pep's often have worked and then been taken apart by the other team. I think what I've seen from Arteta is that it's as though if it were like a video game, you'd be able to like restart. And like if it's Mario, you die 3 times and you can start again, game over. But he can't do that. He has to go with what he's done. And he's tried different systems. Like the first system he put in place was a 4-2-3-1, tried to be high pressing and the stuff you think Arteta would do because of his Pep association mostly, or maybe because of his time playing under Wenger. That's the kind of thing I would just assume naively that he was going to try and do. And then that turned into very quickly this horribly rigid 3-4-3 where everyone had very strict rules. There was no creativity. Like he just stripped any freedom of choice out of his players. And so like if you have good players, often you don't need to give them strict rules, like you must be here at this stage, you must be here at this stage. Like the Pep Guardiola thing is, like Thierry Henry has explained before, his rules of play are he gets you to a certain point and then largely you're free to make choices and that's how you get there. But there were parameters in place to make sure that the way he wants you to create are there. But what Arteta did was make everything really, really strict and took away their creativity. And now he's sort of put this thing in place which facilitates like freedom of movement, rotations. He's taken away a striker to try and do the same thing that Guardiola's done at Man City, but his just has no teeth. It's like a snake without teeth. It's what's the Family Guy joke? It's a belt. There's nothing there. So, yeah, and he could just play a normal like 4-3-3, a 4-2-3-1, and just have a mid block or or press him in a certain part of the team. And he's got Aubameyang up front. Like, he's one of the best strikers in Europe. Like, he is. But yet he's not getting anywhere near enough out of him. And it's because he's trying to do all these fancy bits that he maybe doesn't need to do. Maybe it'll work next season. I don't think it will, but yeah. How long do the fans put up with it, Joe? I don't know.
Okay. Well, Seb, what's the long-term looking like for young Arteta now? Yeah? Because there was obviously huge excitement about his appointment. He was extremely well considered by some of the game's best coaches, as discussed. But that kind of, you know, excitement has hardly translated into results, has it? I mean, it's a bit awkward now, I'd say. A little bit awkward.
A little bit awkward, but I think this might be one of the advantages of being someone with absolutely no CV, not as a sort of a senior coach, because there's always this theory, isn't there, that you don't feel, if this was Steve Bruce's Arsenal, then you could kind of reference it against things that had happened in the past. Oh, this is just part of the Steve Bruce cycle, or the Jose Mourinho cycle, or this is year three and this is what happens. With someone like Arteta, you're allowed to believe that there's an awakening in your future, which is probably to his advantage. But what strikes me as odd is something that you've put in the notes, although I'm paraphrasing what you've written, just blow it all up and start again.
Yeah.
In terms of that first team squad, because there's a lot of players that you just think...
I said that with quite a lot more nuance and finesse than you've just said, like, you know, just to clarify. I said, you know, it had a feeling that maybe sort of it wouldn't be the worst thing for everybody except a few players, not everyone, not blow everyone up, but go, carry on. Just wanted to clarify. I don't want to get into
what but that was like, you've done it in that weird sort of Lord of the Rings voice. That was bizarre. Like, are you some kind of overlord? That was... You haven't even written this in italics, so I don't think you meant it in that voice. So
bring them all down.
Yeah, you definitely know. It's funny because a couple of things are strange about Arsenal. I think there are three or four really good players who are definitely going to be part of their future. Elsewhere, you see Saka. I like Smith Rowe a lot. I think he's a really good player. I think Martinelli, if Martinelli can stay fit, Martinelli is definitely part of Arsenal's future.
Yeah, he's magic, yeah.
Tell us something we don't know, mate.
Yeah, but these things get overlooked. It becomes, and this is part of the problem at Arsenal, because they're stacked to the gills with players from their yesterdays and players who are essentially obstructive to their tomorrows, then you don't get to focus on the younger players. You don't get to build a team around someone like Smith Rowe. Because if you start a sentence by fixating and praising the young players who've developed under Arteta, by the end of that sentence, you've reached a point where you have to acknowledge that, yes, but they've given that massive new contract to Aubameyang. And that feels like, it feels like two parts of the club rowing in opposite directions. And it's a... It's as a result, this, you know, forgetting the results and forgetting Arsenal's position in the league, because of the kind of contradictory nature of the first team squad, it's very difficult to kind of grasp a proper idea of what Arsenal are as a result of it. Because for every positive, for everything that you can look at and think, well, I'll be really interested in seeing what that looks like in 2 years' time, there's something else or somebody else you think, God, if that player's still there in 2 years' time, that's a problem. And it's very difficult. What's the conclusion that you could draw from that?
Could I say also that you know, in relation to Thursday's game, obviously you know, they had injury issues last week, but they'll have some still going into this game. And look, I'm not sure. I haven't checked this morning, but it looked like David Luiz left the pitch with the hamstring injury, so presumably wouldn't be available for Thursday's game. Maybe much longer. But even if they are to sort of overturn the deficit against Villarreal. Is it unfair to say that you can't really see this Arsenal side beating Man United in the final?
No, I don't see that at all. Also, that Villarreal result, let's not forget that actually Villarreal were far superior and that just wasn't a penalty.
Yeah.
It's a ludicrous decision. And so Arsenal's still in the semi-final, yes, but I think it disguises just how inferior they were during that game.
Can I say some stuff is unlike anything I've been able to say for the past year? Because I think, like I said at the beginning, you just reminded me, I was in the pub for this game. And I was in a pub in Islington, so it was, you know, it was socially distanced but stacked with Arsenal fans. By the way, the pub is the Old Red Lion Theatre. Yes, that's Uncle Damien's pub in Angel Islington. What a fine time I had there. And you can have there too. 418 St John Street, the Old Red Lion Theatre. You know, much as I don't want to tell people where I drink, I don't want to bump into any weirdos, yeah? Uncle Damien has asked me to, has repeatedly asked me to say, please tell people about us.
Nicest man in the whole of North London as well, Uncle Damien. Nice guy.
Yeah, he is nice guy. There's a lovely couple of viewing decks for the football anyway, but this gave me a good, it gave me a taste. I feel like I put my finger on the pulse. You remember what that was like when you were around the people and you heard the vibe, and the vibe changed and swelled and peaked, and they were really unhappy with Arteta. I can tell you that. They cheered. I was only half watching the game, and there was a moment where they suddenly cheered, and I turned around and a Villarreal player was being stretchered off the pitch. It was because I didn't realise it's because he had the red card and he was finally leaving. But I thought for a moment, like, wow, I forgot how vindictive people are. But
that would be, it'd be quite funny if you got sent off and you had to be stretchered off the pitch. That, so it's even more humiliating. That would be quite a good.
That's part of the process.
Change of the rules. Yeah.
They walk you all the way around the outskirts of the pitch and show your face to all the fans. But no, they were really unhappy with Arteta. And then after the game, I could hear, you know, drips and drabs of different conversations, people saying like he's been shit all year, or he's always making bad decisions, or I just wonder if that excitement that was there originally, that sort of fire that came along with Arteta, the thing that enabled, you know, that extra bit of time, because I honestly believe that if it was another manager with, or another coach, sorry, with more experience, he would be judged differently. Perhaps would have already reached this point of some discontent with supporters. Arteta, I think, has been given a longer period of time, reasonably enough, because he's essentially new to the role and because he was an Arsenal player, and, you know, all the same reasons why Solskjaer would be given more time, right? But I feel like if something doesn't change for Arsenal soon, I mean, and presumably that will be judged at the beginning of next season, because this season, with the exception of the Europa League, is a kind of foregone conclusion now. And the Europa League feels somewhat foregone too. Presumably they have to get off to a good start in the first sort of quarter of next season. Otherwise, the tone of that debate amongst the supporters is going to sour even more, isn't it?
I think so. I think it would be good to hear supporters in the crowd, because it's much better anyway. But I think you'd see... I think a lot of supporters are starting to become unhappy with it, based on that. And my dad, who is one, and he was pretty pro Arteta until he started to realise, or notice recently, that things have turned like the way you just described. And one thing I think about it that is maybe interesting is that, my opinion is that managers tend to take about 18 months roughly to form a team in their image, and it becomes what they want. And that's if you start from a summer, right? You get a full summer and a transfer window, and then that's what you get. That's roughly what I think Arteta's kind of had. And what he's produced is a mid-table team. And you can judge a team really on their league performances. Like cups, you can get through the random knockout game and stuff like that. And Europa League, mostly they're against teams who should be inferior, particularly if you look at it from like an economic point of view and how much the wages cost and stuff like that. So... yeah, I would say he's seriously underperforming, and I don't know quite why he's getting such an easy ride of it. Because, for example, like Solskjaer was like ridiculed for ages and ages. Everyone thought he was nonsense. But there's a big difference between being a very good coach and being a manager.
Yeah.
And it might be that he's sort of learning that on the fly at the moment.
Do you think there's some value in just being a manager at a club where there are so many other things perceived to be going wrong at the same time? That's very similar to the Solskjaer situation.
Well, you sort of ride the wave a little bit.
Yeah, because particularly at Arsenal, we've seen two or three sort of executive level reshuffles. We've seen some very high profile exits. We've seen the pockets of power redistributed above Arteta and him given new roles. And it creates this perpetual caveat of whatever's going on the pitch. And an extension of that thing we talked about with inexperienced coaches is that, you know, okay, eventually everything's going to fall into place with him, and much the same is true with Arsenal, in that, okay, this guy's in this role now and we're recruiting from this part of the world and with this set of expertise and this is what we believe in, and it's kind of pointing everything towards this sort of non-specific point in the future. And I think that's part of why Arteta gets a little bit of an easy ride.
Okay, alas, we must move on. We've dawdled for a very long time on Newcastle 0, Arsenal 2. But after this, we'll come back and we'll briefly discuss Chelsea, Everton, Tottenham, it seems, other things, and Joe's Quotes and Facts database.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Okay, Chelsea 2, nil Fulham. Just a couple of points here. JJ, two goals from Kai Havertz in this game. Mr. Growth Spurt. Is he peaking? Is it happening?
I don't think he's peaking. I don't think he's begun to peak. Ooh. But we'll know when he peaks. I mean, it's two goals against Fulham, and one of them is... I mean, they're two straight balls over the top. He's done very well with the second one, particularly to finish it, I think. The first one, Mason Mount's first touch to bring the ball down for his first goal is unbelievable. Yeah, I love a first touch. It's like, that is... Oh, I could watch that all day. So that's one thing to say. Also, I mean, he's only the other goal he scored before that was against Crystal Palace in a 4-1 win. He should definitely have got one there. And before that, yeah, nothing. So he's slowly maybe getting used to what he's involved with, but only doing well against the good teams. Like, he didn't do anything in his brief appearance in the FA Cup final. He did nothing against Brighton in a 0-0. I think we all... I assume we all think he's going to do quite well, but it's just this has been a year of adjustment for him. But he's not peaking yet, though.
No, okay. I'm excited to see him peak.
I like him.
Yeah, I like him too. Seb, Chelsea are firmly fourth as we speak. I mean, West Ham play tonight and this is released tomorrow, so it's a good chance this will be completely inaccurate by the time that this is released. But currently, the 6 points clear of West Ham in fifth. With a transfer window ahead of them and good performances since Tuchel's appointment, could they challenge next season? Could they?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think we talked about this last week or about 10 days ago. If they gave the same amount of attention to their back six as they did their front five last summer, then you're going to have a huge improvement. And if they were able to go into next season with new centre-half, perhaps a new goalkeeper, maybe a new right-sided full-back, absolutely, of course they would. And if you work on the basis that they've improved dramatically over the past 3 months, if you parlay that improvement further forward for about a year, then goodness me, they could be a good side. And I always like it when you've got a group of players who are roughly the same age and developing in the same part of the team. And if you think about that triangle between Mount, JJ mentioned, Werner and Havertz, if you developed a long-term relationship between those players, that's a really, really good unit and a really, really watchable unit too.
That could be cool. Okay, well, it sounds like we've already talked about this. Moving on. Everton 1, 2 Aston Villa. Goals from Watkins and El Ghazi. Sandwiched one from DCL to take Villa within 4 points of Everton in the table. How exciting. Ancelotti said after the game it was a cruel blow to their faint European hopes. Not actual quote, lol. Although, weird Everton news. Big rumours about Philippe Coutinho as a possible summer transfer, JJ. Aho?
Is he what they need? I don't know.
I'd assume James Rodriguez would be going if they got one of him, or would they have both of them? That feels very lavish.
Feels decadent. Yeah.
Yeah, that feels like too many. Coutinho might. I don't think that's what they need. He's not for me.
Who do you think they need?
I mean, what they want is someone like Harry Kane. Like, just some amazing player. Like, Neymar. That's what they need.
Right. He might be available. He might be available. Yeah. Okay. Seb, is it fair to criticise Ancelotti? You know, because we pay attention to Everton when they're good, less so when they're not. Injuries, yes, but you've written this question that I don't really know what you're trying to ask. Would you ask it and then answer it yourself?
Okay. Is it fair to criticise Carlo Ancelotti? I think yes, because I think if you look at some of the performances, and Fulham at home, Burnley at home, the draw with Palace when they absolutely dominated and yet somehow inevitably conceded that equaliser, Like, I think Ancelotti, I like Ancelotti.
Me too.
Yeah, but I think that's the issue, is that we like him and so we give him a little bit of a wide berth.
I want to go to a vineyard with him.
He'd be able to talk you through the vineyard.
You know, I want to sit at a sort of rustic wooden table in a Mediterranean sunset and eat sort of Greek food that I didn't think I liked, but when I'm with him, I like, you know? Oh. I want to go there.
And there's a kind of a warm, nice, balmy sunset and you can see for miles and miles and miles. Yeah, that sounds like you're describing a very romantic evening with Carlo Ancelotti. That's very...
And he knows the owner too. He definitely knows the owner.
he would know the owner.
Yeah.
The point is this.
I won't have it.
Though, if this was Jose Mourinho, we'd be all over him, I think, because...
Oh, sure.
Because it's the tax that a manager pays for not being that likable or for being antagonistic. And I think it's fair to ask for a little bit more, because it's not just the results, because we've talked about the glass ceiling, we've talked about what Everton need and what they have and what they don't have, and those are all fair points. At the same time, the tone of the performance sometimes is less than encouraging.
Mm.
You don't think with Everton, this is a team in progress, this is a team that in a year, 18 months time is really going to be somewhere. You're thinking, it's okay. If this player gets on the ball, they might do something with it. If this player doesn't, then that's probably a good thing also, and that's indicative of the kind of the holes that are in that first 11. But I don't know, I think it's under par at the moment.
Okay, well, let's move on. Tottenham 4, Sheffield United. I heard that Gareth Bale scored a hat trick. I didn't watch this game.
He did indeed, and it's that's 9 goals and 8 Premier League starts, which, not to bring him up again, but not great look for Jose Mourinho, that.
Why not? Didn't he buy him?
No, it was made very clear by Mourinho that was a loan deal spearheaded by Daniel Levy. That was very much his transfer. Also, Jose Mourinho made a sort of habit of kind of pointing at Gareth Bale whenever things didn't quite go to plan. Had a few sort of moments when he ostentatiously benched him for games that he thought he might have suited playing in.
Right.
This was fun. This was fun. It was a relief. Caveats about the opposition aside, because Sheffield United are doomed and deeply flawed, sadly. But Spurs were good to watch. They're aggressive and they're imperfect. Their choice of passes in the attacking third wasn't always great. And Harry Kane had a really strange night where he just could not stop missing. But it was fun. And there were little reference points back to Maurizio Pochettino's time at the club, where this rotation amongst the attacking players and inside forwards and number 10s and centre forwards all dropping into different positions and being incredibly difficult to pick up. It was like watching a little carousel at the top of the pitch. And it was fun. And it was everything that this season hasn't really been for Tottenham. And let's not sort of translate that into a kind of Ryan Mason must be immediately appointed as Tottenham manager now, but it was just refreshing. Mm-hmm. It was a nice balm, an anecdote to what this season has been.
Yeah. I'm not happy.
Okay.
I prefer it when the pressure's really on you. I think you're a lot sort of funnier when you're just distressed all the time.
I'm better pod fodder.
Yeah.
When I'm being antagonized and provoked by a bogeyman Mourinho figure. Yeah. But alas.
Whereas now all I can do is ask you to say a couple of words about Real Madrid Osasuna and Lille Nice.
Real Madrid Osasuna was Osasuna even. Osasuna?
So Osasuna. Osasuna. Sorry, I think I said Osuana.
Yeah.
My bad.
You, I don't know what you did there. It was actually deeply boring. And the only interesting bit was Eden Militao almost scoring a fantastic own goal. But the important thing is Real Madrid won, and they won without Modric and Cruz. They rested both ahead of the Champions League this week. So that was a real victory for them. Wow. And reports are that Fede Valverde will be available, although he hasn't played since being diagnosed with COVID. So I find that quite hard to believe. Good result. And important, because Atletico Madrid won 1-0. And Barcelona came back to beat Valencia late last night on Sunday. So,
oh, mate, it's tightening up, isn't
it's
it?
It's really
getting
all
exciting in La Liga.
It's also, you know where it's really interesting? France, Joe.
Do tell.
A couple of things are interesting about this. Firstly, that Lille are keeping pace with PSG, which is just, natural lol, of course.
Ooh.
But also that they're kind of dependent on a 35-year-old centre-forward in doing it. It's just great to watch. Burak Yılmaz is just he's fun. is just...
Barak Yilmaz. I don't know if I've ever watched him before, really.
You should, you should. Well, you'll see him. You'll see him during the Euros because he will be front and center for Turkey.
Oh.
It very much seemed like his days were over, but he's kind of, he's dropped in. He didn't, I mean, he hasn't been, didn't begin the season as a starter at Lille, but he's become fundamental to everything they do and scored the first goal on Saturday night and has now scored 4 in 5 games. Which, for someone who's only 18 months younger than me, that feels, well, a bit humiliating from my perspective. But good for Lille. Well done. And this would be, if they do, they've got 3 games left. They're playing Lens on Friday night away. And this would be a great story. Mm. I mean, obviously, anybody who finishes ahead of PSG in France has done pretty well. But Christophe Galtier, their coach, hasn't won anything since he won a League Cup with Saint-Étienne in 2013. League Cup, which no longer exists in France. It's been abolished. So this is an amazing thing. Like his first league title would be to would involve derailing the PSG of Neymar and Mbappe and Pochettino and all that Qatari wealth. It'd be a fabulous achievement.
Also, one of the best names in football, no?
Christophe Galtier.
Christophe Galtier.
Yeah, yeah. He,
come on, that is... Yeah. Makes me want to eat like a, what do you call it? A big, what is that sort of thing you put in the freezer? A
Viennetta?
Anyone?
I mean,
what
are you talking
about? How does...
I don't know. No one knows where you're going with this. You've just jumped off the
sentence. You know, a big chocolate cake that goes in the freezer.
A gatto.
A gatto.
That's nothing like that.
Imagine me saying it starts with ga, 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 Viennetta. And then you say Viennetta. Well done.
Yeah, but there's nothing other than the alliteration.
Listen, shush up. Stop talking. Stop now. Inter have won a first Scudetto in 11 years, yeah? Seb, finish your canter around Europe now, as you are based in the centre of the continent.
I am cool,
and you know
European.
All things as they've go.
Yeah, Inter won their first Scudetto in 11 years. It's been inevitable for a while. Further down the table, I got very overexcited in the WhatsApp about Juventus possibly dropping out of the top four.
You cursed it, didn't you?
Within about 5 minutes of me expressing my Schadenfreude, Ronaldo had scored twice and Juventus had moved back in top four, so we won't be doing that again.
You just can't stop that guy.
His second goal was going to be your classic Ronaldo back post header where he kind of climbs 10 foot in the air above all the centre backs. Is brilliant header.
There was a
funniest thing that happened to me this week.
Oh, sorry, I was gonna say there was commentary on the highlights of that. I watched the highlights of that Juventus game. And the commentator, I don't know who he is, it's an English guy, and he's always referring to how Ronaldo has saved Andrea Pirlo. And it's the way he's saying it is so dramatic, as though he was going to be killed unless they were to win this game.
Yeah. It did feel a little bit like that, because the camera kept cutting to Pirlo, and obviously, what do we associate with him? He's kind of suave and cool and relaxed and laid back and just all those things. Yeah. And he was as demonstrative as I've seen him.
He's the owner of the vineyard.
He's the guy that Ancelotti knows. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or he's an apprentice learning.
He's got a craft vineyard down the road, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, funniest thing that happened to me, not funniest, I mean notable, coincidental, perhaps, probably not funniest. I managed to watch two games back-to-back, which finished at halftime with a team 5-0 up, which was new. I saw Borussia Dortmund... batter Holstein Kiel, but before that, Besiktas, who were on their way to winning the Turkish Super League, were 5-0 up against Hatayspor with George, Kevin and Kudu running riot on the left side of their midfield, which is...
Well, I would say to you, Seb, that even a broken clock is right twice a day.
Yeah, I never thought I'd see a football league in which Kudu was a force. Like
I was talking about you. I don't know who Kudu is. I was saying that you... Never mind. It's time now for Joe's Quotes and Facts Database. It's Joe's Quotes and Facts Database. Okay, we're in the Quotes and Facts Database now, deep in the database where all sorts of data can be found. And we'll find some now. We're going to go to Manchester United this week because I realised we hadn't done them before. And we're going to start, of course, with Edinson Cavani, current hero of Manchester Yeah, I don't know if he is. According to lifebogger.com, now JJ, you'll hear me reference lifebogger.com quite a lot because they're a great website that you can go to and you can find out about the life stories of almost any player who's over a certain level of fame. That's lifebogger.com. According to lifebogger.com, Edinson's father, Lewis Cavani, would take Edinson hunting. He loves it as a hobby. So I'm reading from Lifebogger now. His hunting spree of wild boars and bush pigs is usually done in the dead hours of night amid the hillside woods of North Uruguay. Wow. Continuing, Lifebogger shows a picture of Cavani's dad holding a rifle and says, below is Mr. Lewis Cavani handling a .243 caliber rifle, which he had just used for his nocturnal hunting session with his son, killing, and get this, killing two boars, six hares, and apparently, according to Lifebogger, some protected creature that we're not allowed to reveal in this blog. Wow! I don't know. That's probably not true, by the way. I certainly wouldn't want it to seem that this podcast was accusing Edinson Cavani of illegal poaching. But, you know, Lifebogger is. So what are you going to do? Lifebogger. Oh. Anyway, this is the quote now. This is the quote bit. And it's
I really like the idea that that's where Cavani developed his excellent movement. In the box, like hunting in the night, nocturnally darting from bush to bush between trees and trees to jump on a boar. I assume he's doing it with his hands. He's got a rifle, but he doesn't need them because he's already there.
That was a duck call there. That's my duck call. And I figured I'd do that because I hit the duck call whenever someone hits the nail on the head or hits the nail on the duck head. Yeah, hits the boar on the square face. Ass. Yeah, yeah. Because the quote now of the Joe's Player Quotes and Facts list for Edinson Cavani and JJ, I think you're going to like this. Speaking to The Telegraph, Cavani said, "You must wait, and then act immediately. You have to be ready for the moment when it's time to attack. It's the same in football. As a child, I didn't connect one with the other, but as I grew up, I realised that these skills are especially important for a striker who wants to score lots of goals." Now, he's talking about fishing rather than grappling a boar with his body. But he's still, you know, fishing and hunting. They're all part of the same magazines. So it's, you know, it's basically, you know, that is... one more time. That's the duck on the head. There we go. Okay. It's the duck on the head. Okay. The next one now. We're going to be over here soon, guys. The next one. Harry Maguire. Harry Maguire. He's a centre-back. Apparently, Harry Maguire's nickname, apparently, is Hefty Hard Man. Did anyone else
know that? Absolutely not his nickname.
It's Hefty Hard Man.
Who's called him that?
Are you saying that there are people in this world that see him in the distance and say, "Oh, Hefty Hard Man, good morning."
Saved on their phone. Oh, look.
It's him calling me again.
Well, it was according to lifebogger.com. And then I did Google it, just say, like, this can't be right. Like, this has to be just a weird... I'm convinced whoever runs lifebogger.com, English is a second language because a lot of it looks like it's Google translated. It's just the strange way. So I thought maybe that's something else. It does appear on a few other sites. It's possible that they're all taking it from Lifebogger too. But nevertheless, Hefty Hard Man is his nickname. And according to lifebogger.com, again, really leaning hard on Lifebogger here, not much is known about his dad, quote, "unlike his mum, who many believe is a strict disciplinarian." But there's no context for that at all. That's just a standalone comment. Not sure why many people believe that. Maybe there's something I don't understand. Maybe it might be a reference that's gone over my head.
I think it's her stats from Football Manager.
It probably is. It's probably the way that she decides to manage the players, the kind of tone that she uses when she talks back to people. Yeah. Strict disciplinarian. Okay, Harry Maguire's quote now. Here we go. Quote, "What's more important is me trying my best to keep my feet on the floor, staying humble, and letting my ability, and not the bin bags, do the talking." Of course, that was in reference to when Harry Maguire was papped, arriving at an England training camp with a bin bag full of dirty boots, apparently. he said, oh, all the other players had bin bags too. I was just the one that got in front of the camera, you know? That's it. There you go. And that's the end of Joe's Player Quotes and Facts database. We'll be back next week with more, probably more from lifebogger.com. Seriously, check out Lifebogger. A lot of fun you can have on there. Anyway, that's all for now. We're at the end of the episode now. Many great thanks to Seb Stafford-Blaw.
Thank you, Jay Devine.
And thanking you, JJ Bull, new arrival. How do you feel that it went?
Oh, I had great fun. I was still really laughing at that Cavani bit. Enjoyed that.
Duck on the head. Well, anyway, we'll hear more from JJ in the future, as he's an employee now and contractually obliged to appear on the podcast. So you can look forward to that. of course, thanks to producer Ollie as well. Wishing all the best to producer Adonis and family. And we'll be back on Friday with some discussion of the European midweek. But until then, farewell, Tipos. Au revoir.
The Athletic.